BCFM 93.2.
You must not believe anything that you hear on this show or from the lips of Dan Rather or George Bush or Bill Clinton or anyone else in this entire world, whether you hear it on radio or on television or from the lips of someone standing right in front of you. Listen to everything, believe nothing until you can prove you yourself. You must learn how to find the truth and prove it. If you can't do that, you might as well turn off your radio now.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Albany Brooks with economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Terror from Baghdad to Munich and Normandy, but after the US coup in Brazil, will there be an incident at the Rio Olympics too? With terrorist attacks every week pretty much now in Belgium, France, Germany, are we seeing a return to the 1970s and 1980s strategy of tension, when terrorism and the mainstream media were used to manipulate lawmakers and the mass population into giving up civil rights and turning to the state for protection? Rather than focusing on the circumstances of one, we look at the recent spate of Euro-terror and ask what lessons can we learn from the previous wave of attacks in the 1970s and 1980s. Our politicians seem to be sometimes the servants of the banksters, and their resource warrior chums, political parties, will give media barons like Rupert Murdoch anything they want in exchange for positive coverage. So this week we look at so-called blowback. Tony Blair's illegal invasion of Iraq appears to have made innocent people anywhere in Europe the target, where a bomb can go off and kill us, or madmen pop up anywhere and shoot us dead any time, just like Kabul or Baghdad. And we look specifically at the Rio Olympics and ask whether now the Democratic President Dilma Rousseff has been removed by the US, can we expect a terrorist attack there, just as there was at the Munich Olympics in 1972 and the Atlanta Olympics in 1986? Also, capitalism died in 2008, and our economies are only being kept alive with a massive injection of quantitative easing. Money printing, meaning wages and employment are stalling, with work no longer a route out of poverty. Millions of us Britons have become the victims of hidden economic warfare by our own government. Silent weapons for quiet wars. But how does it work? And more importantly, how do we fight back? Plus, we have a clip from Fritz Springmeier, the author of Bloodlines of the Illuminati. Our sister show Dialects back noon every Tuesday. This week we go to Cambry Heath to visit Ian Dumbrell, who's been homeless and living in his car for the last 15 months, despite having a disability that means his leg may have to be amputated. After 15 months of waiting and living in his car throughout last winter, he's finally got a flat from South Gloucestershire Council. That's Dialect at noon next Tuesday. But Martin, let's start by having a look at this recent spate of terror attacks across Europe, really starting with the most recent one, this brutal killing of a priest in Normandy.
I don't know what you want me to say about it.
One is that the guy was at the top of the terror watch list in France and been released on a tag, just to sort of run around and do what he wanted.
Yeah, well, I mean, then there are questions of competence or incompetence of the relevant authorities. But, of course, if we're going to compare what's happened now to what happened in the past, you've got to realise that in the past, the terrorism of the Brigata Rossa in Italy, of the Movimento Sociale Italiano, the right-wing terrorists, and other groups were all orchestrated by the intelligence services. And we know for a fact that the Western intelligence services, including MIT in Turkey, were part of NATO, working with the Qatari and the Saudi intelligence services to set up terrorist cells inside Syria. The British SAS were in Syria last week when the Russians bombed a base which they'd been operating in with a particular group. They'd only left some hours before. The evidence suggests that all of these jihadis that have been going into Syria, and we're talking about thousands and thousands of them, have been doing so with the help and encouragement of the intelligence services. At the same time, as the media are telling us, like, these people are terrible, we're at war with them, blah, 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 but Assad must go, and the only way to get rid of him is for these people
to kick him out. Some of the patterns that have been going on with these attacks. First of all, most of them are targeting innocent people, that is to say, people who've played no part whatever in any kind of attack on the Middle East by some of these Western countries.
Well, that's quite right. And Vincenzo Vincinglero, who was a fascist terrorist in Italy, who was eventually caught by the police. And, of course, we know what happened in Italy because the police didn't sit on their hands. They did investigate, and they uncovered the fact that it was the intelligence services who were behind it. And he said, well, the point about it is that we do attack people at random, the general population, because we're trying to terrify people. If you've got people who are suicide bombers, you can carry out hits on hard targets, never mind tube trains and priests.
But this attack wasn't carried out by Vincenzo Vinciguerra, was it?
No, he was involved in the Bologna bombing...
What I will point out, though, is that almost every single case we've had of these, the suspect has been killed by the police.
Well, indeed, because what you do is you set these patsies up. They go out looking for people who've got a Muslim background, but usually, and don't forget, you've got plenty of disaffected youth in places like France who are Muslim origin, but in trouble with the law through drugs
and the guy that ploughed through the people, apparently, with his truck in Nice, wasn't a Muslim at all. He had no actual Muslim connection.
Well, it was of a Muslim extraction, even though he's got no Muslim beliefs.
Middle Eastern, you could call him. Yeah. Certainly not Muslim.
Yeah, but he wasn't a Muslim in the sense of a practicing Muslim, but he was from his family were Muslims, etc. Also, of course, incidentally, the secret police in France have insisted that all video footage of the attack is to be deleted. Because they don't want, they claim that they don't want other people being radicalised by looking at this footage.
Okay, before we get
but at the same
Normandy,
time, the local police are saying, hang on a minute, what do you mean we're going to get rid
before,
of all the
before
footage?
Before we get off Normandy, there is a tradition, if you want to call it that, it's a pretty hideous tradition, of attacks on churches, and there was one in the Coptic Christian church in Alexandria, wasn't there?
There was.
So it's not as if they're saying, oh, this has never happened before. Actually, that attack on that church in Alexandria turned out to be done by some people from the Interior Ministry.
Indeed.
The central government in Egypt.
So in other words, when you see attacks on innocent people or on churches or on things like this, the first question in your mind, given the history that we know of intelligence services like in Egypt and Turkey, Egypt isn't part of NATO, Turkey is, in Italy and France in the past, in Germany in the past. The last bombings in Germany were in Munich in 1980, and they were carried out by the security forces. Now, people have got to realise that in the past, we have overwhelming evidence through police investigation that the Western security forces have engaged in what is known as false flag terrorism. We also know for a fact that NATO and the Gulf countries, including Britain, have been involved in fomenting struggles inside Syria. Roland Dumas, the former French foreign minister, is on the record as saying that he was approached before the war in Syria began by British officials, said, we're going to run an armed uprising in Syria, do you want to participate? So we've got prima facie evidence, pretty strong evidence, that NATO's been involved in funding, arming and training jihadi groups inside Syria.
Let's not forget about Germany, because doctor died after being shot in a Berlin hospital Tuesday, July the 26th, during the fifth horror attack in Germany in just over a week. A string of violent attacks started when an axe man hacked passengers on a train in Würzburg on Monday, July the 18th. A young Iranian-German-born gunman went on a deadly rampage in Munich on Friday, July the 22nd, after being inspired by far-right killer Anders Breivik.
That's disputable.
In two
that's
separate
disputable.
Attacks, on Sunday, July the 24th, a man blew himself up in Ansbach, and a man killed a pregnant woman during a machete attack in Reutlingen. Now, you can't deny these.
Nobody's denying these things happen. The question is, why were all these different people with very different motivations? Don't forget, this Iranian German is going to be a Shia. not a Sunni, and therefore, if things like this have been,
well, there
to
is actually some dispute about whether he had any real link to Iran.
Well,
at all.
Indeed. So the fact that you've got these random people who are just carrying out attacks who haven't got any ostensible political motive, that then fits in the pattern of strategy of tension as well. Because what you do is you just get people absolutely terrified of being attacked by right wing extremists, left wing extremists, Islamic extremists, and of course all of this is being orchestrated, and therefore you then demand extra powers. We've got to go and bomb Syria more, although I can't see how bombing Syria more is going to make any difference to a Tunisian no-hoper deciding he's going to drive
on,
a truck.
Then we come
incidentally,
on
of course, the trucks were allowed onto the Corniche because the police had moved the barriers that they used to that were in place an hour before.
Okay.
These are the kind of questions that have to be asked.
Back to the Nice attacks then, and that was the 14th of July. A terrorist in a lorry mowed down revellers who'd just finished watching a firework display to mark Bastille Day. 84 people apparently killed there. The attacker, Mohamed Louadjej Lahouadej Bouelel, gosh, difficult to pronounce that one, Tunisian-born French citizen, was shot dead by security forces. Martin, you mentioned that the French central government have instructed the Nice city council and the mayor to destroy all CCTV footage. Well, and now a French officer has claimed the interior ministry made her alter her Nice attack report. Her name's Sandra Bertin, and she was in charge of Nice's CCTV control room. She told the Journal de Dimanche newspaper on Sunday an unnamed interior ministry official contacted her after the attack and ordered her to alter the report for the night of the incident, basically saying that she'd seen central government police in certain places where they weren't there on the CCTV.
Well, this when you get tensions between local police officers with their democratic accountability and the intelligence services, this is another red flag that we're dealing with potential false flag terror. And of course, what happened in Italy in the end is that the local police forces working with the magistrates carried out their independent investigations, and Imposimato, who's the head of the Italian Supreme Court, wrote a book about all of this, came out in 2012, La Repubblica dei Stragi Impuni, The Republic of the Unpunished Massacres, where he pointed the finger firmly at NATO intelligence services for the bombing of Bologna railway station,
etc. Let's go back to Brussels bombings. That was March the 22nd, killed 32 people and wounded more than 300 other victims in a day of terror. Two suicide bombings at Brussels airport and another bombing at a metro station in the Belgian capital.
Well, the very least you can say about this is that these jihadists have been encouraged by the Western powers to go to Turkey and to infiltrate into Syria and via Jordan to fight against Assad. And therefore, they have encouraged these very terrorists that then turned around and come back and attack them. So you could say it's blowback. But I think it's worse than that. I think that in actual fact, this is an orchestrated terror campaign by the Western intelligence services. That's pretty much what the Russians have been saying. And of course, they've got their own sources of information that aren't just looking at the internet.
Well, it's not just the Russians saying that. There's actually quite a lot of alternative media around the Western world saying exactly the same, particularly like the Voltaire Network by Thierry Masson, who was one of the first people to call out the 2001 9/11 attacks. Okay, then before that, we had November the 13th, 2015, the Paris attacks, 130 victims killed. Is there anything you point to that, which has kind of transpired since, which we weren't told at the time?
Well, there are loads of anomalies with all of these events. Obviously, the things we know most about are the ones which happen in our own country. So the 7/7 attacks, we've comprehensively looked into
those.
We're
talking about the Paris attacks. Paris attacks, one of the things I would say is that it certainly looked as if these were done by professional soldiers, not by somebody who was just some kind of fanatic.
Well, the other odd thing is why would the Kouachi brothers go out on a rampage and leave their ID very conveniently in a car and so that they can then be identified and assassinated?
And one thing that
would you do that if you were a terrorist?
Pointing to as the start of this was January the 7th last year, that's the Charlie Hebdo attack. Anything you'd like to point out about that?
Well, I'm just talking about the Kouachi brothers who were blamed for it and then murdered. But they left, apparently, supposedly, left their ID in the getaway car, as you would. You know, you'd go off to an assault like that, carrying your ID, and then you'd take it out of your pocket and put it in the car seat as you ran away
also,
from the car, wouldn't you?
One of the things about
that's
that
the obvious
is,
thing you'd
is
do.
That the police guard that was supposed to be there and was there every day for some reason wasn't there that
Yep.
Time.
all of these things tend to suggest that these are false flag attacks. You can never be sure, because especially when an event has just happened, what's got to be absolutely clear is we condemn these attacks. There is no excuse for them. The idea that Tony Blair's attack on Iraq is some kind of excuse for them. Tony Blair shouldn't have attacked Iraq. It was all evil, should never have happened. But nobody should think that gives any justification for any attack of this sort. And when MI5 said, as we're told, they said that, well, Tony Blair, we warned him that there would be more attacks if he attacked Iraq. I just don't think that's a legitimate line of inquiry. These attacks are wrong, whoever carried them out, but we suspect that the intelligence services are the true masterminds.
Now, what can we learn from the Operation Gladio attacks, mostly during the 1980s? Because these were at particular points where European governments weren't doing what the Pentagon wanted.
Well, indeed. So people can look this up. They just do a basic web search for Gladio, and they will find, for example, the three films made by BBC Two, for Frankovich by BBC Two, which came out in 1993, exposing all of this. I mean, most people in Britain simply do not understand that the Western intelligence services created Al-Qaeda and then claimed to lose control of it, although they still seem to be directing it. I mean, Al-Nusra Front, which is Al-Qaeda, Syria, the Russians were trying to bomb them the other day, and the Americans were saying, oh, don't bomb them, they're moderates. Now, that's because they've been armed and trained by the Americans. So, and General Petraeus, who used to be in charge in Afghanistan, openly said, well, we ought to support Al-Nusra Front in Syria, even though they're Al-Qaeda, because they're against Assad. And in actual fact, he's just saying what's already been happening. Most people out there, you know, the knowledgeable, the Syrian army, the Russian army, the Iranian army, they know Hezbollah, they know that the extremist jihadis, Sunni jihadis, are virtually all run from Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Washington and London. It's just something that everybody knows. This is going to become clear now if Turkey decides to drop these people. It may be that Turkey is going to leave NATO as a result of this attempted coup against Erdogan. And in that case, they will probably drop a lot of these. That will be the deal with Assad, that we will drop supporting
these
people.
Another piece of news that's come out this week is that the battalions that were involved in the coup 2 weeks ago, they seem to be, I mean, this is what certainly I've been reading online, several different sources, is that they were part of the NATO Rapid Reaction Force, the Turkish contingent of
indeed.
The
well,
NATO
every
forces.
Every military coup in Turkey from 1950 onwards, and they've had four or five, has been run from the United States and Britain. So why would this one be any different?
Anyway, back to Gladio. Sybil Edmonds has talked about what's going on in Europe. She's a former CIA whistleblower,
FBI
whistleblower, as Gladio 2. What does she mean by that?
Well, she just means Gladio. Gladio ultimately was investigations in the Italian Parliament, the Belgian Parliament, and the Swiss Parliament. And for those who were paying attention, there was an acceptance that in actual fact, yes, the intelligence services had been behind the terrorism. And then people presume that with the fall of the Soviet Union, this kind of extreme anti-communist manipulation was over. And and of course, we did support Al Qaeda in the 1980s to fight Russians in Afghanistan. The SAS train them in Scotland and so on, for example, but that was all over because the Russians were no longer the enemy, and therefore that we could, nothing happened after that. I would suggest that is simply wrong, that in actual fact jihadi terrorism has been a tool of Western intelligence services since the 1980s, when the Safari Club was set up by the French intelligence services. All of these things are checkable. Don't take our word for it. Go and do your own research, and you will see that in actual fact there's a pattern here, and the pattern is NATO intelligence services engaging in false flag terror.
You could actually look at the Gladio attacks back in the 1980s, mostly in Italy, but also, for example, the Bader-Meinhof gang in Germany. There was the beer fest,
Dortmund beer hall massacre,
Oktoberfest. That's the one. killing. Munich, I think that was, and also in Belgium too. That was in a way a kind of rehearsal for what's happening today.
Well, in those days, people were shocked by terrorism. They were thinking, it had a shocking effect. The Bologna bomb, in particular, in Italy, had the kidnap of Aldo Moro, the prime minister, had a shocking effect. It undermined the Italian Communist Party, etc. The Belgians, after their supermarket massacres, did allow cruise missiles on their soil, even though the socialist government didn't want them. The message got through. But I think that what's happened is, because of the relative success of their previous outings, the intelligence services of the West, including the Israelis, have got more and more determined to carry out this kind of assault on all of us.
The two of these recent attacks, we've had German attack in Munich, we've had the Brussels attack in Brussels, of course, which is the headquarters of NATO. No commentary at all that the last attacks in those cities were actually done by NATO. Everyone seems to have forgotten what happened in the 80s.
Well, we haven't, and those who are paying attention will know that don't forget that Muhlenbeek, where these so-called terrorists came from, is right next door to SHAPE headquarters, which is where all Gladio was run from in the 70s and the 80s. Look at the kind of people that are supposedly carrying out these attacks. They are largely people with mental health issues, problems with the law, and problems with petty crime and drugs. I would put it to you that these are not typical hardcore terrorists, not by any stretch of the imagination. They're not the kind of people that used to join the Provisional IRA. They're not even the kind of people that used to join things like the Red Brigades, although they were eventually infiltrated.
And the targets are actually counterproductive to their cause. Not only that, but they're then killed, so they can't give any evidence.
Well, indeed. And what happens is, there's a chap, James Howell, in the US, as you're probably aware, who's handed himself into the police, saying that he was being trained along with Sadiq Mateen, the guy who supposedly carried out the Orlando attack at a CIA training camp. Now, we know that this has been going on, and I think what's been happening in Syria, in particular over the last 4 years, it's right up to date. The Western powers have been arming, training, directing and sending people into Syria to fight the Assad government. They've been doing that pretty openly in Jordan and in Turkey. And then when these people then turn up in Brussels starting to bomb and shoot and kill, is anybody that surprised? That is what, it's not even disputable. And the Syrian government has said this all along. Why is it evil when this guy comes and kills a priest in Normandy, but when loads of priests have been killed in Syria by the same people, you cheer them on and provide them with weaponry?
You can listen again to any shows at bcfmradio.com. Leave comments about your favourite programmes. BCFM 93.2, your interactive station, 24 hours a day.
We cross the Atlantic now, Martin. It's been the Republican National Convention and the Democratic National Convention last week. Big scandal, though, over apparent hacking of Hillary Clinton's email by the Russians.
It wasn't by the Russians. It's probably somebody.
How do you know?
Well, I don't know, but I mean, the fact is somebody leaked it. What the emails show is that basically Bernie Sanders had the nomination stolen from him, and that in actual fact there was a massive voter fraud in places like California. And also, of course, virtually half the delegates at the Democratic National Convention walked out because they said it was a stitch-up, but that wasn't shown on national media in the US.
Or here. Pretty much. I mean, I think this is
extraordinary.
It just shows how totally non-democratic the US is. They put a kind of candidate that no one's going to vote for, as Hillary Clinton, is completely.
Well, they
tainted.
Don't even report the fact that half the people walk out. Which you'd have thought that journalists would report that just
anyway,
as a fact, wouldn't
Democracy
you?
Now had a chat to Julian Assange about all this, because he was the source of the leaks, apparently, not the Russians.
Just before we went to air, a CNN poll came out that says Donald Trump is ahead by 5 percentage points of Hillary Clinton. Now, he did just come off of the Republican convention.
Well, you're asking me, do I prefer cholera or gonorrhea? Personally, I would prefer neither. We know how politics works in the United States. Whatever political party gets into government is going to merge with the bureaucracy pretty damn fast. Corporate lobbyists will move in to help to control those levers. So it doesn't make much difference in the end. What does make a difference is political accountability, a general deterrence set to stop political organizations behaving in a corrupt manner. That can make a difference because that changes the perception of what you can do or not do. And so top emails, this instruction by Louis Miranda, the head of communications, to go out and covertly spread anti-Bernie Sanders propaganda is a clear instruction combined with a chain of command. It's not simply expressing a sentiment. It is expressing an instruction within the DNC to subvert the Bernie Sanders campaign. Then there's a lot of emails about the close relationship between the DNC and the media. The Washington Post involved in a co-fundraising party, an off-list co-fundraising party for the DNC, calling up MSNBC during the middle of a program and saying, pull that segment now. Debbie Wasserman Schultz calling up the president of MSNBC in order to discipline Morning Joe, etc. That's, you know, of course, something that we've all suspected happens, but this is concrete proof of it.
Well, still banged up inside the Ecuadorian embassy, Julian Assange there, really probably the most important investigative journalist on the planet, but the incredible leaks, the devastating leaks, are just not being reported, Martin.
Well, they're only being reported, the spin being put on it by the Clinton campaign is that it was the Russians who hacked the DNC, and that they're wanting Trump to win because Trump's more pro-Putin, etc. The Russians have denied it. I'm sure that they could hack these things if they wanted
to. There's been no evidence.
But I very much doubt, and they may have done so, but I doubt very much that they'd use it to try and intervene in the election
campaign.
Martin,
there's been no evidence that the Russians did, but you probably wouldn't expect evidence. One thing that the Intercept has pointed out, which is a brilliant website, Glenn Greenwald and various other people on there, is that there would be evidence if the Russians had, the NSA would know, and they could present the evidence to the public that the Russians had done it.
They
haven't.
They could. It's more likely that it's a disgruntled insider, and incidentally, somebody who was in charge of communication for the DNC has been assassinated. The police are treating it as a robbery, even though his wallet wasn't and his phone weren't taken. It could be somebody like him that's leaked it, because they're so horrified by the fact that Sanders was cheated of the nomination. And he was cheated of the nomination without the superdelegates, and if the primaries had been conducted correctly, he would be the candidate to take on Donald Trump. And in actual fact, in my view, somebody much more likely to beat him than Hillary Clinton.
Great article this week from Dmitry Orlov, I'd not come across before, on Information Clearinghouse. He says the way things are supposed to work on this planet is like this. The US, the power structures, public and private, decide what they want the rest of the world to do. They communicate their wishes through official and unofficial channels, expecting automatic cooperation. If cooperation is not immediately forthcoming, they apply political, financial and economic pressure. If that still doesn't produce the intended effect, they attempt regime change through a colour revolution or a military coup, or organise and finance an insurgency leading to terrorist attacks and a civil war in the recalcitrant nation. If that still doesn't work, they bomb the country back to the Stone Age. That's the way it's worked in the 1990s and the 2000s. But as of late, a new dynamic has emerged. The power of Niet is the title of the article, and it's really referring to the Russians, saying we're not having any more of this.
Well, that's right. I think Orlov actually was a dissident who escaped from, correct me if I'm wrong, but he actually went to the US and he wrote a book about the collapse of the Soviet Union, and then he compared the current US situation to being like the Soviet Union, that it's going to collapse for similar reasons. It's top-heavy, it's manipulated, it's not a free or sustainable system.
And Brazil, of course, has become one of the victims recently of that.
It has. We've had a soft coup in Brazil where Rousseff has been removed, even though she won the election 2 years ago, and people more satisfactory to the oligarchy in the United States and the local oligarchy in Brazil have been imposed, even though they're much, much more heavily involved in corruption than Rousseff. All they could come up against Rousseff, who had been tortured by the military dictatorship as a 20-something, was that she'd lied about the national debt in order to... And covered up the national debt.
You mean like George Osborne?
Just like George Osborne.
Every other chancellor.
Well, meanwhile, the people that have removed her have been lying about their own personal finances. But that's apparently okay. I mean, there is an offensive going on across the planet by the oligarchy in the United States to try and retain hegemony over the international system.
Anyway, Brazil is where everyone's eyes are going to be looking. I mean, it starts in about a week and a half, I think, maybe a week and a bit, where they have the opening ceremony of the Rio Olympics. So let's have a close look at that tonight. I know there's two people across the planet, I think, are the most trustworthy commentators. One of them is the journalist who was part of the revelations about Edward Snowden and did a lot of the work work on that. That's Glenn Greenwald. So let's hear from him now. And he was talking again to Democracy Now.
Being here in Brazil, where a majority of the country actually was born into a military dictatorship, one that overthrew the democratically elected government in 1964 and then proceeded to impose military rule on the country for the next 21 years, very brutal and oppressive military rule. I'm living in a country here that's actually a very young and therefore fragile democracy, although it's become this kind of inspiring model for the world. It has really thrived. It has made extremely impressive strides in terms of lifting people out of poverty and giving them opportunity and creating mature democratic institutions. And to sit here and witness the utter dismantling of a democracy, which is exactly what is taking place, by the richest and most powerful people in the society, using their media organs that masquerade as journalistic outlets, but are which in fact propaganda channels for a tiny number of extremely rich families, almost all of whom supported that coup and then the military dictatorship. The realization is starting to sink in that what this really is about is two things. One, installing as president and the controlling faction in Brasilia, a group of people who believe in very pro-business, neoliberal ideology that want to dismantle core social programs that have been constructed over the last 20 years and which on its own could never be accepted by the majority of Brazilian voters. And secondly, what it's about is empowering the very people in Brasilia who actually are corrupt, who actually have stolen money, huge amounts of money, and squandered it away in foreign bank accounts and used it to buy second and third and fourth homes and names of other people, the actually corrupt thieves in Brasilia. It's about empowering them so they can protect themselves and kill the corruption investigation. And once people really start to focus on that, as they're doing now, you're starting to see civil disobedience, instability, increasingly violent protests. The real question is going to become, how is the population of this country going to react when they realize that democracy has been taken out of their hands? This combination, this really toxic combination of ideology and self-interest, combined with what I cannot emphasize enough is the central role of Brazil's oligarchical media in inciting and inflaming all of this, in not allowing a plurality of opinion to be heard, in this relentless parade of pro-opposition propaganda.
That's Brazil-based U.S. journalist Glenn Greenwald.
Yeah, well, I mean, Brazil has been a success story for many years when the Partido de Trabalhadores, the Workers' Party, took power under Lula da Silva and then Dilma Rousseff as his protege. Ordinary poor people in Brazil have seen a big improvement in their living standards and conditions. Still a pretty miserable place to be poor, but it was better than it was. But, of course, now this is all about to be smashed and they're going back to where they were before.
Yeah. The other really good writer on Brazil is Pepe Escobar. He's, I think, also Brazilian. And this is what he had to say on RT's Crosstalk.
It is a coup. It's been in gestation since Dilma Rousseff won her re-election in late 2014. The project, if we can call it that, is a perfect alignment in Brazil of the executive, the legislative, the judiciary, and powerful media interests, the offensive against the BRICS as a whole. This is part of full-spectrum dominance, the official Pentagon doctrine of 2002. The hybrid war element, they are fine-tuning hybrid war tools depending on each situation. So yeah. You have a mechanism for Ukraine. You have a mechanism against Russia directly, internally in Russia. Yeah. You have a mechanism in the Middle East, especially Syria. And you have a mechanism specially developed for Brazil, which started with the NSA hack of Petrobras. This was leaked then to a provincial judge in a very conservative southern state in Brazil, who one day from another, he had absolutely priceless information, knowing everything that was going on inside Petrobras. By himself, he will never have access to that kind of information. So this developed into a mix. The first phase of the hybrid war would be, okay, let's try to do a regime change soft or light, which is what we are now. We are the first stage, second stage Senate, third stage the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court in Brazil is also extremely compromised. They don't have the guts or the balls to go against the legislative. So what I spoke at the beginning of the program, the ideal project for this neoliberal restoration is a perfect alignment of the three powers plus media, corporate interests. So it's in Brazil, it's basically four families. And I know these absolute rascals from the inside because I wrote for their newspapers many, many, many eons ago. Okay. So I can talk with direct experience.
I'm sure you can. Let me go.
And how they are pro-military dictatorship in 1964. Yeah. I was 10 years old at the time, and I remember happened. And now they want to do same thing.
Brazilian journalist Pepe Escobar has got a column at the Asia Times, Martin.
Yeah, and he mentioned the term hybrid war there. Andrew Karibko uses this term as well, if people want to look him up. Hybrid war is the Western oligarchy's attempt to control the world's politics by a number of different methods. It involves colour revolutions, so you're persuading young people to go into the streets and rebel against things if they don't like the government concerned. It can involve political assassination. It can involve scandals about corruption. It can involve sex scandals like the removal of the head of the IMF... You remember the
oh, right. Yeah, oh, gosh,
so
no.
It can involve that.
Both of them seem to be.
It can involve false flag terrorism like 9/11 and the things we were talking about in Gladio we were talking about earlier. The oligarchy is the ultimate source of terrorism. And if you think about who they are, they are the Bush family and the Saudis and all the rest of it. These people are terrorists, frankly.
So what about the risks at the Games? Because we were involved, weren't we, 4 years ago in the run-up to the London Olympics in making sure that Shimon Peres and the Israelis didn't have their own little compound inside the Olympic Park where they could do what they wanted. The army stopped that, and then Shimon Peres never came to the Olympics. But also G4S were in charge, and they realised the organisers, with about 2 weeks to go, that G4S didn't know what on earth they were doing, and they had to bring, I think it was altogether 5,000 soldiers in to do their job for them at the last minute.
Well, it may be that there was going to be some false flag attack on the Olympic Games to be blamed on the Iranians, with G4S as the vehicle. That's what's possible there.
What about Rio, though? What are the risks, do you think?
Well, because Rousseff has been removed, I would suggest that there's less likelihood of an attack, because the game is going according to plan from the oligarchy's point of view.
The thing is, though, in order to do an attack, the cover-up, you have to make sure that you're controlling the various institutions to do the cover-up, and maybe Rousseff wouldn't have gone along with that.
She might not, that's true. It's hard to say, but when an incident happens, we must analyse it objectively. And the likelihood is that virtually all international terrorism involving international personalities, people who cross borders, virtually all of that is orchestrated by somebody's intelligence services.
BCFM. Now, capitalism died in 2008, and our economics are only being kept alive with massive injections of QE, printing money. Wages and employment are stalling. With work no longer a route out of poverty here in Britain, millions of us have become the victims of a hidden kind of economic warfare by our government. So let's have a listen now to William Cooper with his reading of this document called Silent Weapons for Quiet Wars, the idea being that everybody can be registered as an economic unit, and then if they're doing what the system wants, they're rewarded with more money. If they're not, money's taken away.
Silent Weapons for Quiet Wars. An introductory programming manual, operations research technical manual, TM-SW7905.1. Silent weapon technology has evolved from operations research, ROR. A strategy and tactical methodology developed under the military management in England during World War II. The original purpose of operations research was to study the strategic and tactical problems of air and land defense with the objective of effective use of limited military resources against foreign enemies. In other words, folks, logistics. For after they developed this operations research and found out that it could be extremely useful, it was soon recognized by those in positions of power that the same methods might be useful for totally controlling a society. but better tools at that time were necessary. Social engineering, folks, the analysis and automation of a society, requires the correlation of great amounts of constantly changing economic information or data. So a high-speed, computerized data processing system was necessary, which could race ahead of the society and predict when society would arrive for capitulation. Relay computers were too slow, but the electronic computer, invented in 1946 by J. Presper Eckert and John W. Mauchly, filled the bill. The next breakthrough was the development of the simplex method of linear programming in 1947 by the mathematician George B. Danzig. Then, in 1948, the transistor, invented by J. Bardeen, W. H. Brattain, and W. Shockley, promised great expansion of the computer field by reducing space and power requirements. With these three inventions under their direction, those in positions of power strongly suspected that it was possible for them to control the whole world with the push of a button. Immediately, the Rockefeller Foundation got in on the ground floor by making a 4-year grant to Harvard College, funding the Harvard Economic Research Project for the study of the structure of the American economy. 1 year later, folks, in 1949, the United States Air Force joined in. In 1952, the original grant period terminated, and a high-level meeting of the elite was held to determine the next phase of social operations research. The Harvard Project had been very fruitful, as is borne out by the publication of some of its results in 1953, suggesting the feasibility of economic or social engineering. And this was published in a book called Studies in the Structure of the American Economy, copyright 1953, by Wassily Leontief, International Sciences Press, Incorporated, White Plains, New York. I suggest you get it and read it. Engineered in the last half of the decade of the 1940s, the new quiet war machine stood, so to speak, in sparkling gold-plated hardware on the showroom floor by 1954. With the creation of the Maser in 1954, the promise of unlocking unlimited sources of fusion atomic energy from the heavy hydrogen in seawater, and the consequent availability of unlimited social power, was a possibility only decades away. The combination, of course, was irresistible. The Quiet War was quietly declared by the international elite at a meeting held in 1954, and the name of that group, folks, is the Bilderberg Group. Although the silent weapons system was nearly exposed 13 years later, the evolution of the new weapons system has never, ever suffered any major setbacks, because no one has ever identified that what is happening to them is being caused by any kind of a weapon system at all. In 1954, it was well recognized by those in positions of authority that it was only a matter of time. Only a few decades, folks, before the general public would be able to grasp and upset the cradle of power, for the very elements of the new silent weapon technology were as accessible for a public utopia as they were for providing a private utopia. The issue of primary concern, that of dominance, revolved around the subject of the energy sciences. You see, folks, energy is recognized as the key to all activity on Earth. Natural science is the study of the sources and control of natural energy. And social science, theoretically expressed as economics, is the study of the sources and control of social energy, or society, as a whole. Both, of course, are bookkeeping systems, mathematics. Therefore, mathematics is the primary energy science, and the bookkeeper can be king if the public can be kept ignorant of the methodology of the bookkeeping. You see, folks, all science is merely a means to an end. The means is knowledge. The end is control. And those in power believe that the end always justifies the means. And beyond this remains only one issue, folks. Who will be the beneficiary? In 1954, this was the issue of primary concern. Although the so-called moral issues were raised, in view of the law of natural selection, it was agreed that a nation or world of people who will not use their intelligence are no better than animals who do not have intelligence. Such people are beasts of burden and stakes on the table by choice and consent, always have been and always will be. Consequently, in the interest of future world order, peace, and tranquility, it was decided to privately wage a quiet war against the American public with an ultimate objective of permanently shifting the natural and social energy, or wealth, of the undisciplined and irresponsible many into the hands of the self-disciplined, responsible, and worthy few. In order to implement this objective, it was necessary to create, secure, and apply new weapons, which, as it turned out, were a class of weapons so subtle and sophisticated in their principle of operation and public appearance as to earn for themselves the name silent weapons. And it was quickly realized that if it was done properly, the public themselves would load the weapons and fire them for the end result of their own destruction. In conclusion, the objective of economic research as conducted by the magnates of capital, or banking, and the industries of commodities, or goods and services, is the establishment of an economy which is totally predictable and manipulatable. Folks, in order to achieve a totally predictable economy, the low-class elements of the society must be brought under total control, in effect, must be housebroken, trained, and assigned a yoke and long-term social duties from a very early age, before they have an opportunity to question the propriety of the matter. In order to achieve such conformity, the lower class family unit must be disintegrated by a process of increasing preoccupation of the parents and the establishment of government-operated daycare centers for the occupationally orphaned children. The quality of education given to the lower class must be of the poorest sort, so that the moat of ignorance isolating the inferior class from the superior class is and remains incomprehensible to the inferior class. With such an initial handicap, even bright lower class individuals have little, if any, hope of extricating themselves from their assigned lot in life. This form of slavery, and slavery it is, to be sure, is essential to maintaining some measure of social order, peace, and tranquility for the ruling upper class. Everything that is expected from an ordinary weapon is expected from a silent weapon by its creators, but only in its own manner of junctioning. It shoots situations instead of bullets, propelled by data processing instead of a chemical reaction or explosion, originating from bits of data instead of grains of gunpowder, and from a computer instead of a gun, operated by a computer programmer instead of a marksman, under the orders of a banking magnate instead of a military general. It makes no obvious explosive noises, causes no obvious physical or mental injuries, and does not obviously interfere with anyone's daily social life. Yet it makes an unmistakable noise, causes unmistakable physical and mental damage, and unmistakably interferes with daily social life. In effect, unmistakable to a trained observer, one who knows what to look for. The public cannot comprehend this weapon and therefore cannot believe that they are being attacked and subdued by a weapon. The public might instinctively feel that something is wrong. But because of the technical nature of the silent weapon, they cannot express their feeling in a rational way or handle the problem with intelligence. Therefore, they do not know how to cry for help and do not know how to associate with others to defend themselves against it. Dear listeners, when a silent weapon is applied gradually, the public adjusts, adapts to its presence, and learns to tolerate its encroachment on their lives until the pressure, psychological via economic, becomes too great and they just simply crack up. Therefore, the silent weapon is a type of biological warfare. It attacks the vitality, options, and mobility of the individuals of a society by knowing, understanding, manipulating, and attacking their sources of natural and social energy and their physical, mental, and emotional strengths and weaknesses. I'm William Cooper, and you're listening to The Hour of the Time.
Well, I'm Tony Gosling, and you're listening to The Politics Show. That was a clip from the 1990s from Bill Cooper reading out that document, Martin, and we're not saying guaranteeing in any way that it's a genuine document, but it's an interesting idea, isn't it? The idea of social engineering through economics, as particularly when you get the idea of surveillance mixed with of everybody, literally massive amounts of surveillance and big databases and profiling of everybody, it becomes possible, doesn't it, to manage a society using economics. One of the things he was saying there, which I don't know if you'd like, is this idea of the occupationally orphaned children. So the both parents are working, and so the children have to be handed over to the state to look after them from a very, very early age.
Yeah, well, I mean, to be honest with you, that doesn't happen in the United States. There's hardly any. What happens is that the parents are disempowered through working too hard, through being denied work and turned into drug addicts.
It certainly does happen in Europe, doesn't it?
Well, it does, but I think the idea that Finnish nursery schools are part of the New World Order plot is exaggerated. The real problem is that it's not just mind control. We've been talking about false flag terrorism here. The 9/11 attacks were carried out by the intelligence services. That's 3,000 people dead. And people worry about being brainwashed. They worry about being microchipped. You should worry about being killed, because that's what goes on. And in Colombia, the people of social movement activists are killed every day. It's just what happens.
They certainly
are. That's social control.
Anyway, I promised you a clip from Fritz Springmeier and Bloodlines of the Illuminati. Worth pointing out that the Queen and her hideous amounts of wealth, she's from the Saxe-Coburg-Gotha family, who were very much involved in protecting the Illuminati as over in Germany in the late 1700s when the authorities were trying to prosecute them over there. But here he is, and he actually, our very own John Cabot gets a mention, Fritz Springmeier.
The misunderstanding that's common out there is that this man, Adam Weishaupt, which was a pseudonym, a name that he had taken actually, started the Illuminati. He did create a modern structure for it. He was paid by these families to create a modern structure. But he didn't originate the Illuminati. The Illuminati goes back thousands of years before him. And the reason why I mention this is that if we go back into antiquity, we will see that there were certain families that were deified as gods, like Pharaoh, Alexander the Great. Maybe some of the viewers don't know that Alexander the Great believed that he was descended from gods. Genghis Khan, who still worshipped in Mongolia. These powerful families believed they were gods, and they controlled through their priesthoods in these mystery religions the people that were subservient to them. They never wanted to relinquish power. They networked together. And over history, you can never find any point in history where they gave up their power. What they did is they did a lot of sleight of hands and went underground or behind the scenes and let other people become front men, but they've still stayed in power. You can see a lot of, I give a lot of evidence of that in my Bloodlines of the Illuminati book. Just some everyday examples that I ran into is, as a boy, you know, I met Henry Cabot Lodge, and someone who would read American history would know about John Cabot exploring the United States, which was of the Italian Caboto family. This is an ancient family, and yet you can see their influence in history all down through the years. Recently there was a book, Holy Blood, Holy Grail. Well, I say recent, it's not been recent, but it became a bestseller, and then the authors made a trilogy of books, Messianic Legacy and The Temple and the Lodge, and Pageant and Lay and Lincoln were the authors of that trilogy of books. And they go in and discuss how all of the royalty and aristocrats of Europe are descended from one single bloodline. And of course, then when you go to look at our presidents, you find that 11 of our presidents, at least 11, are part of that bloodline.
At least 11 presidents are descendants from European royalty.
The Merovingian dynasty. At least.
That's Fritz Springmeier there. Time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7. Up next, a gap in the schedule. We're online, by the way, at thisweek.org.uk, where you can download the podcast. We've got plenty of links up there. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us next week. Don't let the banksters get you down.